This is CliffCentral.com.
I got an email from someone a while ago, and she said that she had a story to tell, and she's got a book that she's written. And I often get these emails, and you kind of throw them away, and you know, say, ah, well, it's another person with what they think is an interesting story. But I have to tell you that the story itself is so riveting and so compelling that there was no way I could have avoided it, and there's no way I could ignore it, and there was nothing that anyone could have said, I think, that would have made any of it seem more horrific than it actually must have been. And Lily Reed is here with me this morning. She's the author of The Dark Seed. It's been described as non-fiction true life drama, but I think it's just epic in terms of the kinds of experiences that Lily's going to tell us about. And in case you are one of those people who is sitting around feeling sorry for yourself today, and maybe you need a reason to be grateful for the life that you have, particularly if you've had a very easy life up to now, then I think this story will help you climb out of your hole. So, Lily, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here, and thank you for taking the time, and hello to your listeners.
Yeah, thank you for reaching out to us. I was just blown away by what you've been through in your life. And we'll get to the story of what happened to you and kind of the healing that's happened since then. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of people who have had awful experiences in their life, and you bounded in here this morning full of smiles, full of energy. You seem like someone who hasn't got a care in the world. Life has been extremely unkind, if you ask me. How do you wake up in the morning and find it deep inside to put back into the world when the world is just taken from you?
It has been a long journey, but I think I was blessed with a very kind of positive frame of mind. I've always been an optimist, not so much of a pessimist. So I naturally wake up and see the good in the world. It takes a lot of hard work. I have to wake up every morning. I sit outside, I have my cup of coffee, and I look up to the universe and the sky, and I just draw in a lot of energy, and I think about all the things that I should be grateful for, from the smallest little thing to looking at my kids that are healthy, and I just start feeling thankful for a whole lot of stuff. And I think it's because of what happened, I learned how to be grateful for the very small things, just being alive, you know, just being able to smell grass or, you know, feel the sun on my face. And it's actually a practice. It's almost like a meditation that I do every day, but coupled with my type of personality, yeah, it's hard, but I persevere all the time, every day to smile.
Do you think when you look at ungrateful people who've had it maybe too easy, do you feel sorry for them? Are you angry at them? What kind of emotion does that drive through you, or you do not think about them at all?
You know, I suppose when I see people that you know, they're lucky that they haven't gone through any experiences like mine. They're lucky that they haven't had to have any sort of hardship in life. But I think I don't feel sorry for them, but I also just think, you know, you're here, your soul's on earth to experience a whole lot of things. And it's always a challenge to overcome each obstacle. And if they're living in a life where they're not overcoming anything and life is just, you know, one easy ride, then what's kind of the point? I'm not saying that they have to go through horrible things, of course, but they should at least give time and thought to what happens with other people. Yeah.
Well, let's start with your story, not right at the beginning, but I mean, what kind of a childhood did you have?
You know, it started off amazing. You know, I grew up in Malawi. That's where I was born. All I remember is beach and sand and sun and thunderstorms in the afternoon and tropical climate and mangoes and grenadillas growing everywhere. I could run into the garden and just, you know, go. We had our own chickens and everything.
What did your folks do?
My dad was he was the the manager of Chibuku, which is an African beer company.
Oh.
And so he used to go up, set up, do all their distribution. And that's how we kind of started moving around a lot, because then he would set up in other African countries. So we went to Lesotho and we set up there. It was a different name, King Corn or something. And then we went to the old Transkei when it was still Transkei, and he set up there. And so we were always traveling like that. And my mom was a beautician. So she would, you know, always have her practice at home or connected to a hairdresser US or something. And yeah, we pretty much just followed where my dad went. Yeah.
And brothers and sisters?
I've got one older sister. She's 3 years older than me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, you started off working in nonprofit.
Mm.
So you were in South Africa from 2007, sort of working with abused kids and poverty-stricken rural communities, violent criminals, the mentally ill, disabled, the dying. You have to have a big soul to spend time around people who need so much love.
Yeah.
People who are so on the periphery of society, people who are often forgotten or who are sent away, people who are permanently excluded from society. What on earth made you want to spend your life and dedicate your time to those people?
You know, I traced it back, and I speak about it in the book. It was the Ethiopian famine. You know, it was back in the 80s, and we had TV. We got a TV. I remember it was in my mom's cupboard, and we were allowed to watch it, you know, every now and again. And I watched the news, and I saw those little kids, you know, starving to death. And I just knew. It just hit me in the heart so hard. And I just knew. I thought, I want to offload maize off a truck. That's all I want to do. I just want to give them food. I just want to hold those babies. I just want to help as much as I can. So when I was in grade 12, which is matric back then, I spoke to my guidance counselor and I said to him, I want to be that person. I want to be offloading maize off a truck. And I didn't know how to get there or anything. And so he phoned Geneva. Can you believe it? Because we didn't know. We were just like in little fishhook.
Sure.
And he phoned Geneva and asked them from the office. I mean, he had never even made an international call. And they said, I need to be a nurse, a psychologist, a doctor. And so I chose psychology. And so my whole direction in life was to always help people, help other people. I had a very big heart. I'm very generous. And, you know, I think I'm quite resilient naturally. So, you know, obviously I was trained, you know, in university. So I learned about, you know, putting up the right barriers and boundaries and, you know, all the right things. And yeah, it's where I get my happy place when I'm on the ground helping people and I see that smile or I hear that thank you. Yeah, that's what makes me happy.
Well, I often think the world is really made up of a very small cohort of people who care about the people they don't even know.
Mm.
And if I can imagine for most people to see that, you know, Ethiopian famine, it would have made them feel sad.
Mm.
But to actually enthuse you with the idea that this is something that you want to dedicate your life to is quite another experience. And I do think that, you know, heroes don't all wear capes. And in this case, there are probably, who knows how many countless lives people like you and you yourself might have changed for the positive. And then it makes it even more difficult for me to deal with what you went through in Malawi in 2012. I mean, when you think back now, because reading your book, I thought this is harrowing. Was it a traumatic experience to relive it, to write it down, to share it? Or is it something you deal with every day as a trauma? Or have you found a way of making sense of it all?
I think, you know, writing the book, because it started as like a Facebook blog and there was no one on the Facebook page. I was just like getting it all out there. It was very therapeutic because I didn't, you know, you've got those dialogues in your head when you could have done this and you should have done that. And I was getting flashbacks all the time and I just wanted to get it all down so that it was out of my head and I wouldn't forget anything. I was so worried of forgetting stuff. So I put it all down on Facebook and that's kind of what turned into the book. And, It was a therapeutic process all the way along because I would have to go back into that experience, into that night, into everything that happened afterwards. And then really I was able to then detach myself a little bit and look at it almost like a case.
It's almost like an out of body experience.
Yeah. Like you look out of it and I kind of treated myself like my own client, like I would as a therapist, you know, and I looked at it and I thought, okay, what would I tell somebody who had gone through this? I would tell them to read certain things, go to the doctor, use these specific tools. And so I started treating myself like that. So in that way, it was very therapeutic.
So let's talk about what actually happened, because by now people must be chewing their fingernails off. So in 2012, you were at home and these guys broke into the house.
Yeah.
And you don't know whether it was 5 or 6.
I counted between 12 and 15 of them.
My God.
Yeah.
And what you do know, because you've had this etched into the inside of your head,
mm-hmm.
is that you were gang raped by, not exactly sure how many of them. Yeah. You were hit in the head with an axe. You were hit with a pipe during the attack. They stood on your throat while they were raping you. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is just the most traumatic and wicked and evil and nasty and vicious and aggressive thing mm-hmm. that could ever happen to a woman. Mm-hmm. And while it was happening, you must have just been numb.
You know, it's every woman's worst nightmare. I mean,
you were on your own.
I was with my children. So both my children were there. I had my partner's 9-year-old son and my daughter, who was 6 years old at the time, yeah, when they broke in. So I think I would have reacted maybe differently if the kids weren't there. You know, I had more to fight for, that's for sure. But yeah, they were there to witness the whole thing.
They were in the same room?
They were in the same room. I was dragged from room to room, many different rooms. And then when they let me go for a moment, you know, they would kind of just rush out the room, obviously distracted by something. And I would run to a room, grab the kids, move them to another room. So my thought was that if they'd already raided a room and the kids had been in there, I would move them into another room that they had raided so that I kind of trying to give them a chance.
What a presence of mind.
You know, I think it's what a mom does.
Instinct.
Hey? Yeah, it's instinct. You know, they're your babies. Of course, you know, it doesn't matter what happens to you as long as they survive. And, you know, through the whole experience, I was imagining that they were dead already. So every time I went to go and find them and I like would move the shower curtain away or I'd look under a bed, I was expecting for Alex and Emma to be dead. I would expect to walk into a room with all these men on top of my daughter, and it just drove me. So every opportunity I got through that night, I would run and try and hide them or find them. I think, you know, one of the worst things that happened was that I got up from the office. They'd been raping me in the office over the desk and all sorts of stuff. And they'd let me go, walked into another room, and I'd quickly run to go to the bathroom and we had hid them behind a shower curtain. And as I leant down to them, you know, Alex looked up and said, "Mommy, I've wet my pants." And I was like, "It's okay, baby, just shush, you know, it's okay." And one of the guys walked in and found me with the kids. And I just thought, you know, there's so many moments in that night when you think it's all over, it's all over. And he picked me up and he threw me into the bath and he hit my head on the back of the rim, on the rim of the bath. And then I kind of came to and he was dragging me by my arm out of the bathroom. And, you know, I couldn't move physically. You know, I was unconscious. I was semi-conscious, and they started raping me again, you know, in that state. I had two men holding my legs. I had two men holding my arms, another one crushing my throat with his shoe. And all of them were just trying to defile me as much as possible.
And at that point, you were just thinking of the children, or you were just trying to not think? What?
No, I was thinking. I was thinking on every level. There was a moment when the one guy hit me in the head with an axe. It was like, you know, they say your life flashes before your eyes. And it was more like my future flashed before my eyes. And I was like, I went through so many things. And I was thinking, oh, you're so dumb. Oh, why did you come to Malawi? Why did you do this? Now you've put the kids in this situation. You know, I'm so glad my partner's not here. Where is he? You know, I was just like thinking. And then I was just like, you've just got to get the kids out of this situation. You've got to get them. Let them do what they want to your body. You know, there's no control that you've got over your body. Just stay alive and get the kids out of the situation. So, no, I was thinking. It was like a bright light had switched on in the room when that axe hit my head. My body went absolutely cold. It went absolutely ice cold. It was like somebody poured an ice bucket of water over my head. And then he left me. And I don't remember it, but from the photographs that were taken afterwards, I'd obviously walked into the bathroom and looked at myself in the mirror or something. I don't know where I was and what I was doing. And then I kind of came to again. And I thought, geez, if I'm going to die tonight, one of these guys are going to die with me. I have to find a weapon. I have to do something to protect my kids, at least distract them, something. But it was just rolling so quickly, you know. Then they dragged me into the lounge, and there were about 10 to 12 of them sitting in the lounge drinking and smoking, like it was some fat party. And they put me onto the couch, and they started raping me on the couch again in front of everyone. At one point, I had one man over like standing over me on the couch, trying to put his bits in my face and in my mouth. And I was trying to move my head. You know, I obviously didn't want that to happen. And another man took my legs and put my knees up onto my shoulders. And I just saw him coming out of the shadow, and he just stabbed me in that place. I don't know what I can say on radio. With a bottle or something like that. Oh, and I passed out again. So, you know, it was every time, you know, kind of passing out from either just shock. I don't remember feeling pain. You know, I think that's one solace that I can say is like when you're dying like that, you're not feeling any pain. You always wonder, you know, is it going to be painful when I die? And it wasn't painful at all. I was bleeding from everywhere. I mean, they'd beaten me up so badly. My eyes were swollen shut.
You know, when people talk about rape, they think it's a sex thing.
No. Yeah.
No. And having experienced it, you can say firsthand, and it's something that psychologists always talk about, that it's just a complete manifestation of power and a cruel one at that. It's about defiling.
It's
about proving that you're better than.
Yeah.
It comes from a deep, nasty, insecure, vulnerable place.
That's it.
You can only wonder what happened to these men.
Well, this is what I also write about in the book, is that, you know, I kind of lifted myself out of that experience, and I think this was the key. And I'm not saying that everyone can do this if this happens to them. This was just what happened to me. It just kind of happened.
Most people can never talk about this, which is what makes your book all the more remarkable. But as you were saying.
Thank you. I kind of lifted myself out, and at a moment in time, I looked at these men, and I thought, what on earth happened to these boys? That they, what have they experienced? You know, because I've worked with people, you know, I've worked with criminals, I've worked with everyone. I know what goes on in these homes and how they've been abused to become men like this. But what I hadn't had experience of before is working with anybody who had experienced gang rape. So my mind was going, okay, I understand the one-on-one rape, I understand all the things that go behind that, but for a group of men to get together like that, what does that mean? What could they have gone through, and how do they, you know, they've obviously been sitting, they must have been sitting for a while
planning it.
So, you know, for 15 guys to be sitting around going, yes, we're going to go in, and there's this woman with her kids, her partner's leaving on this night, and this is what we're going to do to her. And they were all involved. So when I say that I was gang raped by 5 or 6, those are the ones who entered me. But the rest of them still gang raped me, because
they were watching.
Exactly. So it was all of them.
What a sick, sick world we live in, where this kind of thing can occur. Where it's acceptable behavior. I mean, surely one or two of them in the group might have said, guys, this is not right. You would think that, right?
Yep, you would think that. But I think, you know,
it's depraved.
It's depraved. You wouldn't even treat an animal this way. You know, at least if you're going to, you know, slaughter a pig or a goat or something, you just cut its throat and let it bleed out, and there we go, you know. But this is kicking, hitting, biting, scratching. It was just so disgusting, using other objects, you know. So it's got nothing to do with sex. I mean, half of them couldn't even get an erection, so they were getting even more frustrated, so they were using other instruments and stuff. When I came out of it, I mean, I had so many bruises on my breasts and scratch marks down the, you know, insides of my legs, and just things happening to my body that I didn't realize could happen. It was like having gone through a hurricane and being right in the center of all this chaos, just being tossed. I said to another interviewer the other day, you remember the movie Carrie? And I had this long blonde hair. I was like this complete beach babe, you know, like on the lake and everything. And I looked like Carrie at the end of it. The blood was just insane, just coagulating everywhere. My arm was, you know, I broke my arm. I didn't find out until many months later that it was actually broken. It was just absolute
savagery.
Yeah, you know, animals don't even treat animals that way. So,
Lily, how did it end? How did it stop? When did that final moment arrive where you thought, I made it through, I'm alive? Because you must have been, that was all you could have hoped for.
All I could hope for was really that the kids would stay alive. And I know that I had to stay alive in order to see that they stayed alive. You know, there's no point in me dying. And what happened at the end was that when I saw them crashing into the house, I phoned the landlord of the property that we were staying on. And it took over an hour, but he had phoned the military police. And it was kind of like my last stand. I was standing in another bedroom. I'd moved the kids down to a very, very far part of the house. And I'd hidden them under a bed, and I'd been lying under the bed as well. And then I couldn't lie under that bed. I thought the axes were going to come through the bed and all this kind of stuff. But I'd pushed them as far under the bed into a corner as I could because I'd heard gunshots. And for some reason, I thought, I don't know if it's something I heard. I don't even know if it's true, but that I must put them in a corner so that if a bullet comes through, it would not go through the cement pillars of the corner of the house. I don't know why. I don't know if that's true. Anyway, I pushed them there. Then I'd gotten out from the bed. I was still in just a little t-shirt, naked from the waist down. And out of the passageway came all these men with guns, you know. And you remember, it's pitch black. So all I can see are teeth and eyes. That's all I can see. And they came running down. And I got such a skrik, you know. I turned around, and there was another guy in the bedroom that I didn't realize. He was the chef, and he had come out of the cupboard, hearing, obviously understanding the Chichewa that was being spoken. He knew it was the military police. So I got one fright, kind of looking down the passage, turned around, and there was another guy in the room, and I was trapped between both, and I just collapsed on the floor. That was it for me. I just knew that I'm dead. I'm dead. I can't do anything anymore. And then the little boy, Alex, he speaks fluent Chichewa because he grew up there, and he was going, "Mom, mom, mom, you know, it's the landlord, it's the landlord." So you know, then I kind of came to and looked, and I saw the landlord coming down the passage, and that was how it ended.
Now there's your trauma,
which
you said you found certain ways to deal with, and then there's the kids, and maybe there's a huge amount of guilt in you, even though none of this is of your doing, that your kids had to see this.
Look, you know, I have been very, very conscious from the moment as it was happening that I would have to get the kids through this in a very special way. Luckily, because I was trained as a therapist, you know, I immediately started their therapy. So it was, you know, as soon as I got back, you know, we were talking about it. I was trying to fill in the pieces, the missing pieces for them, because, you know, sometimes they were just hearing. Can you imagine hearing your mom screaming, you know, like, "Don't kill me, leave the children. You know, I've got kids." I was telling them that I was pregnant, so that maybe they wouldn't rape me. So they were hearing a lot of things. And then, of course, as I was coming into the rooms to find them, I was more and more beaten up each time. So, you know, a lot of the therapy I did with them was very much immediate. We named the situation a code word called pineapple. And so every time they were feeling a little bit anxious or they wanted to talk about it, they would say, "Pineapple, mommy." And then I would give them extra love or do whatever I could. Look, I couldn't do much while I was there besides give them love. There was one thing actually I did. They'll kill me if they hear this. But I made them little babies again. Okay. I bought them bottles and I bought them dummies, and a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old I had wrapped up and swaddled like you do with a baby. And I would just hold them at night and give them a bottle. They would laugh. You know, you can't even suck a bottle with teeth, but they just loved it. You know, we did little dramas and little plays. I got my daughter some therapy there from Fountain of Life, which is a charity there that helped me. It was few and far in between. You know, we were traveling so much. You know, my partner at the time just wanted to run everywhere, so we were never in a place more than a day. So it was really difficult. So her healing started when we got back to South Africa and I could normalize her life again, create a really secure, safe space where everything was normal again. You know, she goes to Nana's house, she goes to school, she's got her friends again, mommy's fine. I think the biggest thing for them was that mommy's okay.
But yeah. I mean, you couldn't have been okay because you'd been gang raped by a bunch of guys and you didn't know what diseases they had. You didn't know if they'd make you pregnant.
Yep, I had all of that going on, and so I was given STIs by them. I don't know if I was pregnant by them. I thought I was because I was actually pregnant when I came back to South Africa, but it was my partner's child, but that I miscarried.
You must have been, but I mean, you must have thought, uh-oh.
You know, I was asked this as well before, you know, would I have kept the baby if it was from one of the rapists? Now, I've had an abortion before. And when I fell pregnant this time round, I thought to myself that it would be a gift and that I wouldn't abort regardless of whose it was, because I saw the child as maybe like a beacon of hope, or, you know, it wasn't the baby's fault. And you must remember, if I was pregnant, even from the rapists, that baby is still part of me, you know, that's half me. So when I found out that I was pregnant, I was back in South Africa. It was around about January, and I found out I was pregnant, and I couldn't calculate the dates. I was really confused about when it happened and what had happened and when I'd had sex again afterwards with my partner. But I remember taking the test. I was living at my mom's house, and my friend was in the garden, and I came out running and going, "I'm pregnant, I'm pregnant." Like, oh, I was just so happy. And they all looked at me like, whose baby? Whose baby is this? And I was like, no, but I'm pregnant. I have a baby. Like, and so I think that I don't know what would have happened. You know, maybe if I'd, you know, thought about it more, maybe if the doctor had confirmed that the rape or that the pregnancy was much further along and was a result of the rape, that I would have changed my mind and aborted. But at that time, I just remember going, no way is anyone taking this baby. And, you know, I miscarried, unfortunately, at about 4 months.
I mean, that's probably, for me, one of the things that I found really amazing and at the same time a little bit disturbing about the story is that you wouldn't have aborted this child if it had been one of the rapist's kids.
Yeah. I don't know why. Maybe it was like,
gee,
I know. And I'm not saying that women shouldn't, you know, it's our legal right. I worked for Maurice Stopes for years, you know, so I'm very much an advocate for abortion as long as it's safe and all of that.
Sure.
But at that time, I just thought, you know, maybe it was my muddled mind. I just thought there's no way anyone's taking anything away from me again.
I don't get the impression that there was a muddled mind ever.
Oh, I was cracked, eh? I've had a long time to write the book and all the experiences, but
there's such presence of mind in the actual event that happened, but subsequent to that, the way you dealt with your kids, and obviously it's training and all that stuff too, but it's like you didn't really, you had a plan.
Yeah. You know, it was that whole gratitude thing. I know it sounds so weird.
But where do you put yourself in all of this? Most of us would be thinking about ourselves at some point. You didn't. It's the kids. It's this child who might have been born, that might even have been one of the rapist's kids. And you're thinking, oh, you know, this could be an innocent child that I could use to heal and improve the world. Not me, me, me. There wasn't me, me, me in this.
Yeah, I suppose I haven't really thought about it. I haven't thought about the me part. I saw it as a, I don't want to sound like crude, but I saw it as an opportunity. I just thought, oh my word, I've been working with people like that have gone through these experiences, who've had to make these choices every day. And I'm always there, you know, doing the therapy, helping them make good decisions. And now it's happened to me. Like, oh my gosh, now I actually know. Now I know. So I saw it as an opportunity, and I thought, if I can, you know, I wrote a letter to the president. I went and delivered it to Joyce Bunda's door. I really thought I was going to get in. I wrote this whole long speech to her about, you know, it's happened to me, and I just want to help other Malawian women, and this is what women are going through every day. Can't you use me as like this vessel, this voice, you know? I'm not scared to talk
again,
about
it.
Again,
you're thinking about yourself. You're thinking about other people. It's really, it's extraordinary.
Okay, thank you.
I mean, just from the observer's point of view, I'm not a psychologist, but there's such a generosity of spirit there. I mean, after something like this, most people would just flee.
Yeah. I didn't want to be one of those. I did not want to be a victim that just crumbles and falls. There was just no way that was going to happen. No way. I've worked too hard in my life to get where I am and raise my kids. And, you know, I've been a single mom. I've run my own business. I've just done too much.
Was it too much for your partner?
Yes. 100% yes.
He didn't know how to deal with this?
No. And because, you know, there were rumors that he was the cause of it. So I've never had an answer from that. You know, I'll never, ever know. But, you know, it was just very strange that he had left that night. And, you know, he feels very guilty about that, and he's very remorseful, and he, you know, wishes he could have been there. But some parts of this puzzle just don't add up. He was the last person to arrive back. He was only like 2 hours away. And so, and I was told by a lot of people it was a revenge attack on some sort of business deal that went wrong.
Oh my God.
So, you know, I've had to deal with that, of course. You know, I've had to, but I've also come to the point where I'm never going to know. He's never going to tell me the truth. He might not know, but I know he knows. I know he knows, but he's never going to tell me.
That's even more terrifying, you know, that there could be so much underlying
this. Oh, there's so much underlying stuff there, you know, so much. And I just know I'm never going to find out.
And you don't have, you're not like full of anger and hatred, huh?
No.
Really?
No.
Jeez, I'd be so angry.
I know.
I mean, the men in your life, the people who care about you, must be so angry.
Yeah, you know. Look, I'm remarried now. I remarried my previous husband. He was there for me 100%. He flew us back the one time.
Is this the father of your little girl?
No. So my little girl, I raised on my own. Her father lives somewhere in the UK, so I raised her by myself. And but I married Adrian, my husband now, when my daughter was about 2 years old, and then we divorced in 2011, and I left for Malawi in 2012. I fell pregnant with Martin's child, which I miscarried, and then I fell pregnant again with his child, and this is the little boy that I've got now. So I've got two children. They're not my husband's children, but he has raised them like his own.
He must be a special dude.
Oh my gosh, I can't tell you. He's amazing, absolutely amazing. Gentle, kind, accepting, so non-judgmental, soft, hard when he needs to be, excuse the pun, but you know, it's like...
I love the way you can still joke about this stuff. A lot of women are terrified of sex after this happens to them.
Yeah. Look, it took me a long time to get back to that.
You know, it hurts physically, mentally, spiritually, emotionally.
It does.
And I'm sure it did take you a long time. How did you start to develop a sense of humor, let alone any kind of normality around that?
You know, the sense of humor was always there, and that's what got me through. People were appalled by some of the jokes I made. I mean, but that's my dad. My dad's given us quite a crude, you know, below the belt sense of humor our whole lives. So we've always used that as like a coping mechanism to break the ice in awkward situations and stuff. I mean, some of the jokes I crack, as long as I can crack them, you can't, you know, but no, I can. And then just kind of like breaks the ice, and you're just like, you know what? It's over. It was a moment in time. Let's get on with things. If this can break the ice and you can see that I'm okay with it, rather do that and start a real conversation
than have boring discussions and never really get to the meat of the story.
Yeah.
Well, it's such a story, because then obviously it doesn't end. You got cervical cancer because of the attack, right?
You know, I probably had quite a few other STIs, but luckily I'd organized for, you know, I knew my rights, and I had to actually organize from South Africa.
Antiretrovirals.
Yeah, antiretrovirals, and I got injections for syphilis and gonorrhea and all the other things. But a few months later, when I was back in South Africa and I was getting the correct treatment, I was found to have 5 different strains of the HPV virus, the human papillomavirus.
Oh, wow.
And they were all the cancer-causing ones. Yeah, so I had to go through that. That was a shock, because after after 6 months, you know, I knew I was clear of HIV, which I was just so grateful for. I mean, for me, that was just, wow. I just couldn't, I think if that had been one of the things that had occurred afterwards, I don't know what I would have done. Because, you know, I don't want to die. I want to raise my kids, you know. I don't want to have this like death sentence over me. And I'd been through so much. I just wanted to live, you know. I want to live so much more and experience so much more. And I'm not scared of anything, you know. The worst has happened. So the worst has happened. I mean, the chances of it happening like that again are so slim.
When you're in bed at night and you hear a noise, you don't...
I skrik.
You don't jump to horrible conclusions.
No. You know, I thought, sometimes I think about getting a gun, and then I think, oh my Lord, you know, with my little bit of a temp, I'll be shooting the guys at the robots, you know, like, no. And then I just thought, no, if I want to, I don't want to bring fear towards me. I don't want to bring that fear. If I'm thinking all the time of all the bad things that can happen, I'm not going to be the happy person that I am. I've got to think about all the good things that are happening, and then the universe will supply me with what I need and open the doors that I need to be able to be a happy and content person. I can't be like that, because then my daughter will grow up like that.
Yeah.
I don't want to show her that world.
What kind of things would you like people to take from the book? What would you like people to know, to learn, to use for their own purposes? I mean, what's the intention outside of just the catharsis of doing it?
Yeah. I think there's two or three things. One is that, you know, I haven't read any books where women have spoken about the real violence that goes along with it in the kind of detail that I have. And, you know, they talk about like what happened before in the lead up, and then kind of like I was raped, held onto the bed, and then I healed, you know, and this is what I did to heal. I wanted to give people the insight into how savage these things are, because if they can understand that it's not just a sexual act, like, okay, you know, he lay on top of me, we kind of had sex and I said no, it's not like that. They really hurt you, you know, they're physically trying to kill you, really, you know. So I wanted people to understand what rape really is. That was the first thing. The second thing was that I wanted to highlight how all the trauma afterwards, you know, people re-traumatize you by the things that they say and by the way that they treat you, how medical professionals, you know, can be so blunted and harsh, and that all you need is like your hand to be held or a little hug or, you know, a comfort pack. For goodness sakes, you know, I had absolutely nothing. I couldn't brush my teeth. I couldn't wash my hair. I had no knickers. I had no clothes. I had nothing, and no one was around, you know. So all of those kind of charities you hear about, you know, that are giving comfort packs and sanitary pads and all of this, it helps. It really helps. I could have had so much more dignity after that. I had no shoes. Like, I had no clothes. So I had one, like, little Malawian dress that had been made for me. And for, like, months, I had no shoes. I came back to Joburg here with no shoes, you know, still, like, just an absolute wreck. I would have loved to have something like that. So also just to highlight how you can, you know, how you can come towards a person if you kind of like that first person who arrives or one of the medical professionals, or, you know, just give them some of their dignity back, please. You know, you can be that person that tells them everything's going to be okay, love. You know, you're going to be okay. You're alive. You're fine. We're going to look after you. Here's my telephone number. Call me if you need anything. This is where you're going to go for a counselor. Help them in the process. Don't just stitch them up and send them away. You know, surround them with all the tools that they're going to need. And of course, there's NGOs that do that, but they can only reach so many people, you know.
For those of us who are interested in a little retribution, I mean, did they do anything with these guys? Catch any of them?
Apparently, they shot one. Another one died in prison from being beaten up. I saw him. Yeah, it was awful to see him. You know, he was just all full of...
You saw him dead?
I saw him very beaten up, and then I was told that he had died afterwards. You know, I went to go and identify him. And I think that the policeman thought that I would enjoy seeing that he had been beaten up, and it was just sick. It was really sick. So they opened the door, and he was lying in his own feces, and his face, I couldn't even recognize it. And I was like, I can't ID this guy. And they were like, no, this is the guy. This is the guy, you know. And they showed me a photograph, and he had obviously been arrested as a criminal before, and they were trying to say to me, this is him. And I said, I'm not IDing that guy. I have no idea who that person is, you know. And then they caught another four. And I had to go into court to testify against them in a tiny little room. I mean, it was no bigger than your studio here. And they were standing not even half a meter away from me. I could smell them. I could see them. They'd been in the prison since the arrest, you know, so you can imagine the stench and the just foulness around it. And I had to look them straight in the face and tell them exactly what each of them had done. And then they got to cross-examine me with no preparation. I wasn't prepared. I didn't have a lawyer or anything. Yeah. And I just had to stand up. My partner and a friend of mine had gone back to the house to take photographs of the scene. So I had to go get those printed, look through each one, say to the judge, you know, this is what happened. Can you see the room here?
Yeah.
There's the axe. That's my daughter's backpack. There's my laptop. It's all the stuff that we're caught with them. I know that man, you know, that's the dark one. That's the gardener. That's this one. Because I named each one of them as they were raping me. I looked at them top to bottom and I named every single one. I knew exactly what they looked like, so what they were wearing, everything. So as soon as I saw them, I knew exactly who they were. Yeah. And so I testified against them, and that's the last that I heard. Never heard anything again.
You didn't hear whether they were found guilty, sentenced? Are you just not interested?
Not interested.
Wow.
You know, not interested. What can I do? The judicial system on that side is, it's a third world country. You know, whether they were found guilty or not is not going to affect my life here in South Africa. They're gone. You know, they're gone. I've taken myself as far away from them as I can to protect my children. There have been some instances where I've got a little bit of a skrik. You know, I got, my parents got a phone call saying, from a guy saying, I want to speak to Lily. And they said, you know, Lily doesn't live here. And they said, we know she lives there. Tell her that Snake called. And I'm like, who on earth? And so then I started panicking, you know, then I started panicking. Like, why would somebody phone my house and say that they Snake, you know, like after, it was about 2 years after the attack. So I was wondering if they had gotten out, you know, and they had all my belongings, remember? So they knew exactly who I was, where I lived in South Africa, my telephone number, everything was there. Yeah. So I got a little bit of a skrik then, but if you look at the prison system there, if they were in prison for all this time, they wouldn't have survived. They would not have survived.
Lily, it's an incredible thing that you've done here, and I'm gobsmacked. I don't know what to say about how sensible you've been.
Sensible, yeah.
You really have. You've been so sensible about everything. And a lot of people would have got caught up in the emotion or even feeling sorry for themselves, which you're allowed after something like this justifiably to feel for as long as you like. Or to make it about them and to kind of wither away and isolate themselves from everybody because of fear. But you did none of that. You were smart and you were forthright and you care about your kids and you care about other people. And you're still doing work with other people.
Yes.
More than ever.
More than ever. Yeah. More than ever. It's, you know, I've connected myself to an NGO called Women Against Rape. And, this lady, Janine Rowley, she's up in Pretoria. She runs 17 centers for children. And these children have been abused or raped and they're housed in these homes. And she is so dedicated. I mean, like, what a saint. She does not stop. She goes to the police stations. She goes to the hospitals. She picks up these kids, picks up these women, puts them in homes, gives them their comfort packs, counsels them through, does everything that she can. I mean, she has not stopped for 17 years. No one knows about it. You know, she's not there to get a pat on the back. Nothing. She's another soul like me. You just want to help people because you've gone through something similar. And I just think her organization is amazing. So I'm going to do what I can to help there. You know, all the big organizations, they've got lots of money. They've got all their overheads, all of that. And they kind of lose touch. I've worked for many of them. So they lose touch with the ground. This woman is hands-on every day. She visits all of her centers. She has kids staying at her house. She's got so much going on. And she's human. She's real. She's like me. So I'll do what I can for them. Yeah.
You're amazing.
Thank you.
There's no other way to put it. And it sounds patronizing, no matter how I say it. But you know I mean it.
I know.
And,
thank you.
And what you do here is probably going to affect people in ways you don't even know.
Yeah, I didn't realize what the book would do. You know, it was kind of like I didn't expect to get, you know, published or for any of this to happen. I just wanted to talk about it. I just thought, geez, you know, it's happened. I've got a voice. You know, I can speak eloquently. I've kind of intellectualized a lot of stuff about this process. It's not what I thought, you know. So I think that was like the big thing for me, is like all the stuff I've been taught is so academic. And now I've actually experienced it. So I can speak from both sides. I can say, you know, they say this and this and this, but that doesn't really work, you know. I think there's a lot of stages that you have to go through to get to a point. I'm not saying anyone's going to get to the point that I'm at the moment. I'm very, very blessed in how I've coped with it. Yeah. But if you can see that you've gone through certain stages and then you get to a point where you can start helping other people and then you realize, oh my gosh, okay, there's like 10 stages to this and now you're at number one and you know, maybe I'm at number four and I can now go help people that are not at number one who have just been raped, you know, then you can actually see your progress. So that's why I like helping other people and talking about it, because there's people that email me that are just like, oh my gosh, I'm like 60 years old and I've never spoken about it before. And now I'm going to tell my sons, like finally, after all these years. So I get a lot of emails and, you know, I'm trying to speak to everyone that I can. I don't have all the solutions, but I think people just need a space to talk about it with somebody who's gone through it. And I'm there. I can do it.
Look, I'm sorry it had to happen, but who knows? You might be a super psychologist as a result.
As a result, yeah. I don't need a degree. I need to be like, you know, get the honorary degree.
Well, the honorary degree in life experience is yours already. You don't need anyone to tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck.
Are you allowed to swear on radio?
Something I like. I mean, this is, there's no other appropriate response. Sure.
Yes.
Listen, keep doing your good work.
Thank you.
Thank you for emailing me. I'm really happy we had this conversation.
Me too. Thank you very much. And congratulations on your station. I'm really proud of you. I've, you know, obviously followed you from 5FM all the way through.
Oh, wow.
And it's an honor to be here and to see what you're actually doing, because you're going to change the world in your own way. You've got such honesty. And I just love that you've had the courage to step away from the norm and just do your thing. So, congrats.
The honor is all mine this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Gareth. Thanks to your listeners.
Lily Reed's book, The Dark Seed, is out. You must get it. You must read it. And I think pass it on to anyone who you know has been through even a vaguely similar experience, because it'll give them hope. Mm-hmm. You've come out of this, and she's got hope, and she's got dreams, and she's got a future, and she's alive. Okay. And there's nothing going to stop you.
No.
Hopefully not.
Thanks. Thanks, Gareth. Bye.
This is CliffCentral.com.